It's not apparent from photographs that Dmitri Shostakovich smiled much. The great Russian composer suffered for his art. He was at first feted, then cajoled, criticised, condemned, and many believe compromised by the wicked political construct that was the Soviet Union. But despite that, he still managed to produce music like this, with a sense of playfulness. Perhaps it was that playfulness that kept him going. Perhaps. Carl Jung, another 20th century icon, not exactly associated with a good laugh, once said of play, "The creation of something new is not accomplished by the intellect, but by the play instinct." Now, for a very long time, it was customary to think of play as an activity of secondary importance, as a side issue to daily life, the thing you did when you got all your real jobs out of the way. But it occurs to us here at Future Tense that in the digital world, play is an important driver and motivator of activity. In other words, the dynamics of play are at play in much of what we do online. So what does that mean for individuals and society? That's the question we're examining today in the final instalment in our summer series of highlights, the best programs of the past year or so. Hello, Anthony Fennell here, and welcome to Future Tense.
My name is Tom Chatfield, and I'm a British author and commentator on digital culture.
And Tom Chatfield is the first of several guests we'll hear from in this program. People who are being playful with the idea of play and pushing its boundaries as a force for innovation and future living.
I think play is a really sort of brilliant emblem of a lot of what is going on online a lot of the time. It's kind of crossing over from being something sort of for fun that people did in their leisure time to being, you know, a way of thinking about technology. Because we talk about user experience, there's this intense Darwinian competition for people's, you know, very limited time and attention. And more, you know, the idea of pleasurable user experience is becoming, you know, one of the defining features of apps and programs and services. And they are very busily learning lessons from games, because the art and the science of making something fun and engaging, you know, has reached really quite a sophisticated pitch in games, in terms of interfaces, in terms of feedback, in terms of knowing the sweet spot between challenge and reward, where you're sort of taking someone by the hand and guiding them through a process, but you're reinforcing, you're asking them to do stuff, but not too much. So, you know, play for me is quite an important modern emblem of the way in which we are almost reverse engineering from the human brain online and building services that are expressly designed to tick our evolutionary boxes, to reward, to entice, and to give people, you know, social incentives above all. You know, we love comparing ourselves to other people. So in the broad sense, you could almost go as far as saying that, you know, things like Twitter or Facebook are a kind of a very clever game, because, you know, people have a profile which they care about, and they are sort of constantly in the business of trying to make numbers go up, really, trying to get more followers, trying to get more likes, trying to get more tweets or retweets. They're comparing themselves to other people. You know, again, in sort of Twitter, there's a sort of global scoring system where you can see where you're ranked. And there's these sort of, you know, very playful dynamics as well, whereby, you know, you are free to do anything you like within the rules of the game. You know, within the sort of little magic circle there on screen, you can switch on, you can switch off, you can like, you can unlike, you can really indulge whimsy. So that's one thing. But on the other hand, I would say that this is one way of talking about play, but there is the, you know, the rather more kind of profound creative playfulness that can go on. And often the kind of locked down systems you find online that are sort of targeted at good user experience can close that down, can stop people from playing in the more creative sense. And I think there's a real tension there between sort of giving people kind of easy, low-level, constant, rewarding play and building environments which are rewardingly and constructively and excitingly playful. The game Minecraft is one of the great modern examples, I think, of a rather brilliant sandbox, like a sandpit that you can get into and build castles and build anything you can imagine and, you know, really let your creativity run riot. And, you know, we don't see that much of that online, actually. We know that doesn't tend to make as much money. It tends to be sort of harder and more serendipitous to do. So there's a little bit of a battle going on, perhaps even over the meaning of play and playfulness and this kind of pleasure-led interaction.
If that's the case, then should we see the hacker culture, the DIY culture, as an attempt to fight against that locking down, to actually embrace play?
The word hacker is so fraught as well. You know, back in, this is when talking about the histories of words, back in MIT, you know, hacks were originally pranks. And, you know, to be a hacker in the very early days of computing was to be someone creative who thought outside the box, who could put together a solution, you know, but who also had a sense of mischief, but a very creative mischief. And now a lot of people like to refer to themselves as makers. You know, they have sort of maker spaces and things like that to differentiate themselves from, you know, black hat hackers or those who just want to perhaps make a political protest or just cause grief for the sake of it or make money or be involved in the criminal aspect of things. But the culture of making things, of taking things apart, understanding how they go together and putting them together again, you know, in a way sort of you understand, that is absolutely a response and a way of pushing back against this sort of locking down of possibilities. And it is playful, I think, in the most sort of creative and straightforward sense. And it's highly collaborative, of course. It's about people coming together literally in physical spaces and sharing each other's recipes and ideas. And the great thing is, you know, there's always been this strand in sort of geek or computing culture. And it is encouraged by some people. You know, in Britain, the Raspberry Pi computer has been a huge success, a tiny little cheap computer that is designed for you physically to be able to sort of see how it works, combine it with, you know, sort of all kinds of different outputs, code for it, do your own thing. And, you know, people who are hacking in a creative sense have done amazing things with things like Microsoft's Kinect, for example, the culture of Kinect hacks, this incredibly powerful box that can watch you through stereoscopic cameras and has a microphone and stuff. So, you know, people are very much pushing against these constraints. And very often that means crossing over from just the on-screen to the physical as well.
My name is Eric Zimmerman. I am a game designer and a professor at the Game Center at New York University in New York City. Playing games is part of being human. The way that making and listening to music is, the way that telling stories helps us be better human beings.
Now, something you need to know about Eric Zimmerman. Professor Zimmerman is an expert on game dynamics, as you've heard, and he has this theory that we've now entered what he calls the ludic century. Ludic being an adjective, meaning of or relating to play or playfulness.
What I mean by the ludic century is the idea that one way of looking at the times in which we live is that games and play are central to this time. In a way that, for example, information and the moving image were central to the 20th century. That film and video were the main ways that people expressed themselves in the sense of personal narratives, news and journalism. Epic narratives were spun out in filmmaking and on television. And while, of course, there were other forms of important culture that happened in the 20th century, like radio, for example, in literature and music and other cultural forms, the moving image, in a sense, is kind of paradigmatic of information in that it is information that is passively accessed by an audience or a viewer when it's broadcast or projected. In contrast, games are doing something else with information. They're not storing information, which is later accessed. Games really let you play with information. And this is true whether you are moving the pieces on a chessboard and exploring strategies and the psychology of your opponent, whether you are playing tennis and exerting yourself as you try and follow the rules of the game to overcome your partner, or whether you're playing a computer game. Maybe you're playing Minecraft, in which you're really in a sea of information and you are overcoming obstacles and hazards, but also you're building things and creating the world as much as you're exploring it. So games are a cultural form in which systems are central. And systems are really the paradigmatic concept of our time. I feel that we're living in a world of systems. The way that we communicate to each other, the way that we work and learn, the way that we socialize and flirt and romance, the way that we engage with our governments and conduct our finances, all are mediated by digital networks of information. And that means that what it means to be literate today is something which has to engage with this idea of systems.
So there's a mind shift required here, isn't there, in a sense, because many of us are used to the 20th century idea of play as recreation. I mean, we box it in that way. It's not what we do for work. It's not part of our working day as such. But if we're talking about the sort of century that you're talking about, a ludic century, play is very much there. It's not just recreation. It is that. But it's also there at the heart of everything we do, isn't it? Or will be.
Yes, and I think that's a good way of putting it. I think that our concepts of what constitutes play and the boundaries between work and play are shifting. Whether this means that we all have to make a conscious shift in our attitudes and approaches to the way we live our lives or not, I think is an unanswered question. There's a sense in which the importance of games in our culture is both cause and effect of the ludic century. So that, in a sense, it's happening now, whether we want it to or not. This idea that more and more of our lives are engaged with complex systems of information. And I do think that this is not just happening in industrialized democracies. To a certain extent, it's happening all over the world. And one often sees now in the developing world that there's a leapfrog over traditional forms of infrastructure, such as, you know, landline telephones, to cell phones, for example. And a cell phone network is something which is already kind of systemic and modular and open to more forms of playful improvisation than a traditional telephone network. For example, microloan systems for people to rent time for international calls on cell phones. So I think that this idea that we're living in a time in which play and games are central permeates many aspects of our lives. I also should say, however, that it's possible that all of this is just my myopic bias as a game designer. I myself make games for a living. I play games. I have a passion for understanding how games work and for inventing new forms of play. So I don't think that the ideas of the ludic century necessarily have to be thought of in terms of games and play. But I do think that games and play provide some of the best examples of these systemic forms of culture which are emerging now.
With the idea of play, traditionally we associate it with a certain amount of freedom and also enjoyment. In a world that is a world of systems, as you describe, is that play that we're going to be doing or that we are doing in different forms, is that always going to be freedom and enjoyment? It seems to me that won't necessarily be the case.
That's an excellent question. I think that games paradoxically embody both harsh, fixed, rigid system of rules and also the playful, creative improvisation that is play. They are both of those things. And the fascinating paradox for me is that in a game, the wild, free-form, creative innovation that is play emerges because of the constraints of the rules. So that if you and I were playing chess and kind of pushing the figurines across the grid without really paying attention to what they are and what they did and how we might play the game, we could have fun and maybe we would have a bit of narrative play, but we wouldn't invent something that people dedicate their lives to, that people write books about, that, you know, there are centuries of history around the way that people engage with this system, the system of chess. So I think that in games we see that play and rules or systems are inexorably entwined. And perhaps that's one of the defining features of games and play. And for me, it's one of their great enigmatic mysteries.
I think play is a very important, creative force, because ultimately, what do we mean by progress? If we mean by progress doing the same thing again, but very slightly better, sort of incremental, iterative processes, that's something that can perhaps always, be accomplished by a team of smart people working according to a known plan. But the moment you want to be disruptive, to be, to use the cliche, outside of the box, the moment you want to challenge the assumptions that perhaps other people don't even realize are holding a field back, you do need to get serendipitous and playful in some sense. You need to be able to do perhaps a very practical kind of play, but you do need to take things apart, see how they work, put them back together in different combinations. And also, you need to understand people. And this is not something that people who work with computers are famous for doing, having vast reserves of empathy. But, again and again in the history of technology, we see an underestimation of the importance of, appealing to people's sense of fun and delight and possibility. The earliest home computers were expected, when they went on the market, to sell a few hundred copies to enthusiasts. They sold thousands and thousands and then tens of thousands. And, again, with the sort of social media services, in many ways, a lot of the progress that's been made within a service like Twitter, for example, is because people have played around with its possibilities. Really, the people who made it just created a sort of micro-blogging service with no bells and whistles at all, and said, right, here you are, world, let's see what you make of this. And people used it and began to play in that space and came up, really, with everything from retweets to hashtags to trends to Follow Fridays to, this kind of architecture that's made it, well, we don't quite know what, but made it something, new, something unprecedented. Now, if they'd come up with a lockdown system that they'd thought in advance, they knew exactly how it was going to work, we probably wouldn't have had any of these things that have, had an enormous impact on the way a lot of people exchange information online.
Tom Chatfield again, and before him, Eric Zimmerman. And this is Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell, and today we're playing with the idea of play and its role as an innovator and forward mover. Time for another quote. And this time, I'll dispense with the need for a dubious accent. It's a quote from the legendary American film director, Frank Capra, who once said, "Play has been man's most useful preoccupation." And that brings us nicely to our next guest.
My name is Alex McDowell. I'm a production designer for the past 30 years in film, and I'm just recently now a professor at USC School of Cinematic Arts, teaching world building.
And Alex McDowell's production design credits include the films Minority Report, Corpse Bride, and Fight Club. Now, aside from his extracurricular work at the University of Southern California, he also runs his own creative think tank. It's called the 5D Institute.
5D started really as a forum, as an excuse for me to call up anybody and say, hey, would you like to have a conversation about the future of play? Or, how do we start creating a methodology that transcends the silos that we're working in? So I started talking a lot with people in the games industry and interactive media. And we were talking a lot about design process, but we were looking at it very broadly as a way of thinking about creating media. 5D's done several events centered around that idea of play as the kind of core creativity and as a liberating way of thinking about the imagination. We are very focused. I mean, I am very interested in just looking at my own children, but there's this moment in play in childhood that is completely liberated, right? You're taking a stick and a stone and you're imagining it to be whatever you want, a spaceship and a, incredibly sophisticated, imaginative play is going on all of the time with children. And we lose that ability completely. And we're very interested in what I'm doing at USC in many ways and what 5D is doing, is how can we create the sandbox, the kind of conditions of genuinely stimulating kind of play and retrain ourselves to think entirely in the imaginative space. And from that, you know, kind of develop a capability for storytelling in a new way. A lot of that has got to do with, in a way, new toys. You know, like we've got some fascinating toys that we've never had in history before, like gesture-based technologies, or, you know, sculpting digitally, or wearing a head-mounted display and living and being entirely inside a virtual world of your own making and getting absorbed by that. And so that we think that there is a lot of very good and interesting technology-based stimulants that bring us much closer to play. I'm personally not a technologist at all, but I've used technology as a tool to help develop, you know, the kind of design of the story spaces for a long time. And I've found that the more that technology develops, the closer it resembles the way that we actually think. It's far more intuitive now for me to design in 3D space than it ever was to design on a drawing board, you know, and kind of make plans that are going to evolve into 3D objects. And that feels to me like there's this opportunity for developing the idea of play as a serious way of working in the imagination space. So I'm totally fascinated by that notion.
Now, for a long time, of course, play was frowned upon for adults, at least. You know, that idea that you gave away childish things, childish ways of behaving. The new technologies that we have, these creative new technologies that we have, as we develop more of them, is that feeding in a sense? I mean, in a way, they come from play, but are they feeding back in then to the rehabilitation of play as an innovative device, do you think?
I think so, although I think that the artists have had a free pass as far as play goes. You know, I think that those of us who've been able to, been lucky enough in a way to work in like the media space or the art space, have never been that far away from sort of thumbing their nose at the at the adult constraints. So we're all pretty childish to begin with. But there's no question that I do see these developments in technology, especially now where we've sort of got beyond the point where you have to know how to code to be able to run a machine, you know, where that sort of idea of user-friendly is becoming expectation. You know, we have the expectation that technology will do what we want it to do without us needing to necessarily be computer scientists. And I'm really, in that playful way, I'm really enjoying the opportunities that we have right now with some of these tools. And clearly, the idea you can picture where any number of the tools that we have now in our hands, what the cell phone is, you know, it's fascinating to me, and I love the perversity of the fact that the cell phone, the phone, is almost the least useful function of a phone these days. You know, it, on the whole, it's just a toy to open doors into other spaces. And in fact, I wish it would stop being a phone completely, really. And so I think that our everyday devices are becoming more and more like liberating tools or toys that we can use. And I think people are getting more and more invested in the idea of where the imagination can take them, because they can see how it can actually turn into materiality now. I think that idea that you can 3D print a gesture that you can make in the air and you can turn it into an object, it's really a mind-twisting paradigm shift.
I'm Adrian Hon. I'm CEO at Success Starts and also co-creator and lead game designer on Zombies Run. One of the things that play allows us to do is to sort of turn structured time into unstructured time. You know, living in London, one of the things that really surprised me when I moved here was how people's time gets booked up, you know, weeks, months in advance. So every minute is sort of spent working out, you know, where you should be, who you should be talking to. Whereas with play, you know, the best kinds of play are where you lose track of time and you get engrossed in something really fun, really fascinating. I think one of the most odd things that's happened with smartphones, with tablets, is how this has kind of returned to a lot of adults. I mean, kids have always played, and people who are into games have always played. But people like my mum, who plays Angry Birds on her iPad, this is a new thing, I think. And, you know, that one of the things that people have always said about the fact that we have our phones next to us, you know, 24/7, is that it means that we, you know, always on, we're always working, which is certainly true for some people. But I think that at the same time, if we can sort of inject play experiences into those devices that we have, then we can return a sort of sense of enjoyment and serendipity to things if we design it correctly. And that's, you know, that's partly what we try to do through our games and what other people are trying to do.
Has play in the last couple of years, has it changed for adults? Is it now more acceptable for adults to say that they engage in play, that they like to play games?
Absolutely. I don't think there's any doubt about that. You know, gaming has, you know, well and truly entered the mainstream, and I think that's simply because we now have these devices which you can play anything, and people don't seem to be bothered by the fact that, you know, they're seen playing silly games like Candy Crush. But, you know, I would say that I think that a lot of the games that people are playing are pretty shallow, and, you know, I'm looking forward to when people sort of move on in terms of exploring, you know, more interesting kinds of games.
So it would be a mistake to draw necessarily a connection between, say, play and creativity.
Well, you know, I think you could sort of draw a very broad line through those two concepts, but and certainly there are people who say that, oh, well, you know, play is required to be creative. That's probably true, but I don't think that if you play, you automatically become creative. I mean, if I spend, you know, 2 hours playing Tetris, that's not being creative, that's just me playing Tetris. And there are certain kinds of games that foster creativity, and there are certain kinds of games that are less good at doing that.
I don't think that games are valuable just because they give us literacy skills or make the world a better place. Games are valuable because play itself is something which is intrinsically valuable for people to do.
And that was Professor Eric Zimmerman in New York, and Dmitry Shostakovich, of course. Before them, London-based game designer Adrian Hon from the company Six to Start, and earlier, author Tom Chatfield and production designer Alex McDowell from the 5D Institute. Thanks to the production team, Carl Elliott Smith, and sound engineer Peter McMurray. Incidentally, the music from this program was The Waltz No. 2 and variations thereof. Transcripts of all of our programs are available from the Future Tense website, as is the audio. So if you've missed an episode or want to hear it again, simply search the words RN and Future Tense and you're bound to find us. And remember, if you want to follow us on Twitter, by all means do. Our Twitter handle is RN Future Tense, all one word. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next week, cheers and bye for now.
Meet the ABC Radio app. It gives you access to RN on your phone, along with 19 other ABC radio networks, including local radio, news radio, Classic FM, Triple J, and all our digital-only stations. The ABC Radio app also has program schedules, links to our current ABC emergency coverage. It's free. Download it by searching ABC Radio app and take ABC Radio with you on your phone.